Good afternoon. Let me start with road safety. Today the Cabinet made decisions that are aimed at making our roads safe by cracking down on drink driving, in particular the worst repeat offenders who put others' lives at risk. I will announce those measures now with Stephen Joyce and take questions, then we'll move on to other topics. So Cabinet has agreed the following changes to tackle New Zealand's drink driving problems. The National League Government will crack down on recidivist drink drivers with a zero drink driving limit to apply to those people. Secondly, there will be a zero drink drive limit for drivers aged 20 years or under. Much tougher penalties for, drivers aged under 20 years. Much tougher penalties for repeat offenders and drink driving causing death and serious injury. And compulsory alcohol interlocks for repeat drink drivers, which will prevent the vehicle starting if alcohol is detected. These changes should be in place early next year. You'll be aware that Cabinet had been considering the issue of whether to lower the blood alcohol limit from 0.08 to 0.05 in order to be consistent with a number of other countries, including Australia. The Cabinet reached a conclusion that before it was able to make that decision, it needed firstly clearly demonstrate to the people of New Zealand that a problem existed for drivers between 0.05 and 0.08, and currently that information is not complete. Over the course of the next 2 years, a record will be kept of all accidents where drivers have an alcohol level of 0.05 to 0.08. This information will be made publicly available. At that time, Cabinet may well be in a position to decide on a reduction from 0.05 to 0.08, and we would note that the United Kingdom is also considering such a reduction. But let me say, it's worrying to me that last year 36,000 New Zealanders were convicted of driving with an excess alcohol level. That means that on any given day, 100 drivers are being caught over the legal limit. If we're going to get community support for an even lower limit, we need buy-in to the idea that the issue of drink driving on our roads can be combated by a lower adult limit than we already currently have. We need, as a government, to take the people of New Zealand with us on this issue. So on that note, I'm going to pass over to the Minister. He'll make any remarks he wants, then we'll take some questions, and from there, after that, we can go on to other issues. So Stephen, we're in your hands.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Just really wanted to add that it's a comprehensive package which seeks to tackle, in particular, the serious issues of young drivers and alcohol, repeat drink drivers and alcohol, and also those people who on our roads drive recklessly, either with alcohol or without, and cause death. The other element that's very important as well is the alcohol interlocks, which is an initiative which tries, which will seek to deal with some of the issues where we have people unable to divorce their driving behaviour from their drinking behaviour. It's not going to be a solution for everyone, but it's a step forward in terms of dealing with some of the issues around people who are currently driving while disqualified. And we need that opportunity, as I say, to divorce those two elements. So happy to take any questions. No, I don't think that's true, Guyon. Certainly, somebody as slight as myself, that's the current limit. But there are people of all shapes and sizes, and some of the concerns that have been expressed to me personally around people worried that if they have one or two drinks, they'd be over the new lower limit. So I think we've made quite a bit of progress in terms of discussing that with New Zealanders, but I would say have more discussion to do. I've said since being the Transport Minister that it's important we have a very broad level of support for the law changes that we make. Because it's a very democratic place, the road, there's a lot of people on the road, it's very important to have that support. I think we're not yet at the stage where we are with, say, for example, the cell phone law.
What evidence would you need to get from the survey of crashes between 0.05 and 0.08?
We have a couple of things that we're looking at. One of them, as the Prime Minister mentioned, is this issue of clear understanding of those that have accidents between 0.05 and 0.08. Currently, a number of those people don't actually have blood alcohol levels recorded, because under the law, if they're not injured in an accident that they're involved in, and they are given the normal test, the normal sniff test for blood alcohol, and they pass it, then that's the end of the matter. And of course, that means that they could have well had an alcohol level between 0.05 and 0.08, we don't know. So part of the legislation will be making a change to enable that data to be collected from people that have an accident for research purposes, which will give us then the opportunity to have a definitive count of the impact of those drivers on the road. Well, I don't think that's correct, because they'd probably also tell you that if you didn't allow anybody to have any alcohol, then they'd save more lives, and if you actually didn't let anybody drive, then that would save the lot. So I think the reality is that we always strike a balance between what laws are acceptable for New Zealanders, and over a long, long period of time, that limit has been 0.08. We've been discussing moving to 0.05. I think the discussion will continue. In fact, the Prime Minister has signalled that the discussion will continue. Once we have the data that we're going to collect over the next 2 or 3 years, then we will have more information that will enable us to help make that decision. But it is a big decision, and it's one that, as you all know, has been grappled with by various governments for the last 20, 25 years.
So how do you get that data? Does that mean everybody involved in a crash is going to be
pre-tested? Every driver that is involved in a crash with the police, where the police know that alcohol has been involved or suspect alcohol has been involved, will be breath tested. And the difference is that at this point in time, if they put in front of the basic test and it's pass or fail, if they pass, then they are not, then no further testing is done. And what we'll be saying is that we'll be wanting an evidential breath test for the 0.05 for the 0.05 element. And if they're over 0.05, it will be recorded. But again, only for research purposes.
Then will that be compulsory?
That's the intention, yes.
So if a person gets breath tested and they're under 0.8, the police officer will say, I'm now going to give you a separate test to see if you're over 0.5.
That's right. That's the intention of the legislation.
So it should be two tests.
Well, it is now. Whenever you, if you fail a test, you always do a second test. So in this instance, you've had an accident. Police are worried that alcohol is involved. They give you the first test, they'll give you the second test. No, it is now an evidential breath test. Somebody can always, at this point in time, choose a blood test for evidential purposes, but the reality is that this is not for evidential purposes, this is for research purposes. No, I've been very clear all the way through. It's amused to see it described as a back down today. I think you'll find that all my media quotes in this matter has been that it is a choice between two and that it's been finely balanced. And I've been very clear on that all the way through. And often, Guy, you've asked me for my opinion and I haven't given it to you. The reality is that I think it's finely balanced. I've always had that view, and Cabinet today has made the decision. I'm saying it's ridiculous for me, knowing me as I do, reasonably well, to drink 3/4 of a bottle of wine and then drive after an hour and a half. That's my personal view, and that was the view I was declaring at the time, and I won't be doing that, and I don't do that.
So, but do you think it's ridiculous for people?
No, I said to you that there's all different sizes and shapes of people, what for some people is six standard drinks. And I think that's some of the concern. There's a worry that we might be making some unsuspecting individuals who, for whatever reason, the metabolic rates, because it isn't exact, this stuff, the metabolic rates or the size of the individual, that they might end up having a glass or two of wine and then being in the position that they are over the limit. Now, the officials will tell you that's not the case, but the reality is that's the concern out there, and I think we have to move slowly in this direction and be sure that, A, we understand the benefits of the change, and, B, that everybody broadly is in support of that change.
In regards to the interlocks, who will pay for them, and what's the cost of those?
The interlocks would be designed to be user pays, i.e. paid by those that have the interlocks. And the prices I've seen are in the order of $150 a month that it would cost to have one of those rented and then fitted in your car.
Does that pose a whole marketing problem in terms of somebody else blowing into their device or
Well, that's a potential risk, but the reality is right now we disqualify somebody from driving because they have been drink driving, and they can then choose to get behind the wheel, and a number of them quite regularly do. So this is an opportunity to manage the problem and to get people to separate their drinking from their driving. It won't be for everybody. It'll be at the court's discretion, and obviously judges will make the decision as to whether they think this person is the right person for this interlock or not. But it is an opportunity to separate that interlock, that drinking from the driving. Of course, also you'd have a situation where there is ways of checking. Oops, dropped some of these. Prime Minister.
It's still going. It's right.
Very good. Checking whether they've been tampered with. There's all sorts of technology now in terms of taking photos of people as they blow into them, so that you know whether it's actually being done by the person who's driving the car.
Didn't you also say there was some sort of method where, you know, you might have just blow into this thing every 20 minutes?
There is the potential of people having to drive in as they proceed through a trip, yes. We haven't worked out all the final details of all of that yet, but that is one of the ways in which they ensure that the same person is actually using the interlock.
Well, personally, I think it's quite a serious issue because 36,000 people each year are being prosecuted for being in excess of the current blood alcohol levels. Now, I do want to see a reduction in that number, and I do think it's possible over time we will actually move to a reduced limit. But I think for that to apply, we actually need New Zealanders to buy into that process, and over the next couple of years we'll be hoping to demonstrate to them that that is an issue. We'll be also hoping to demonstrate to them that the actions we've taken today, which I think are actually quite tough, are working, and that includes zero alcohol limit for young people under 20. It means zero alcohol for recidivist people that have been caught. It means interlock devices, as the Minister said, much harsher penalties. So, you know, we have got a package of initiatives here, and I think we've got to move New Zealanders towards really buying into the process that there's no room for drunk drivers on our roads.
When you talk about recidivist or repeat drivers, are you talking about second occasion or third? I mean, is it going to have to find it?
How it'll work is that the second time somebody is caught would be where they qualify for the nil limit. So the first time, they're by definition, of course, not a repeat, but the second time they would then be a repeat, and they would then have that nil limit applied after their period of disqualification. It's planned at this point that limit would go for 3 years before they would revert to being somebody on the normal limit. The possibility of interlocks will apply for the second conviction, and also at some levels on the first conviction, but that's at the discretion of the judge. There would be a mandatory disqualification period of 3 months before anybody qualifies for one of the interlocks, and there'd be a minimum 12-month period. But generally, I would think apply at the same level as their current disqualification, and then they'd have to earn their way off the interlock program, which requires a 2-month period of no issues at all with the interlock.
Just on the data thing, the first brief that you blow when you get stopped, that all after you have a penetration sort of a screener, and the second one is the evidential one. What happens if someone blows over 80 on that evidential? Because we all know that sometimes it takes a little longer for the alcohol to get through. Would they be then
prosecuted? That's a very good legal question, Mr. Kay, and I have to check that with the officials. We haven't been through that part of the exercise, but that's a possibility. We'll look at it.
But you haven't given thought to what might happen in that?
If somebody passes the first one and fails the second one, no, I haven't, but we'll work through that as we put the bill together.
What's the
We've talked at Cabinet about a 2-year period once the legislation has been passed to enable the full collection. That would give us 2 years of data that we'd then have the opportunity to make a pretty good decision. I think that's for government to address at the time. We'd want to be firstly fully informed that as to what level of crashes involve drivers with that level, first of all. And the difficulty we have now is we have some of that information, and we have a lot of conjecture in the public whether that's not much or whether it would be a lot more, and the short answer is that we do not know. So in order to make a decision that the public will support either way, then we need to have that information.
You'll be able to anticipate the criticism that will come from some of the drivers.
any stats on international evidence on this. You've got advice from your own officials. Mm. Why couldn't the government be involved and taken some leadership like this?
Well, there is significant evidence internationally, and a second part of the research we want to do is to replicate some of that, more of that in New Zealand. But this is a very challenging issue. I mean, some countries internationally have 0.05, including Australia. Some have 0.08. It's one that that New Zealand has debated for 20, 25 years. This is not a new debate. And we've had very mixed views. We've had some research recently that suggests a small majority in favour, and we've had other research which suggests it's very much 50-50. Now, we've been clear that in the transport area, we want to make sure that the new laws and rules that we create have very broad support, because ultimately the police aren't everywhere. Ultimately, the community does need to support the limits that are in place, and they need to understand those limits. And really that's what the Cabinet's saying today, is that before we make any change, we need more information and more public acceptance than we currently have.
So you obviously thought that if you announced it now, you would suffer the backlash from the public?
Well, it's not just about that, because it's ultimately about whether this is enforceable on the roads. And that's the crucial thing. You remember a time back in the 90s where there were some changes around speed limits which involved quite a backlash against the police and the way that enforcement took place. And that actually was counterproductive, ultimately, for the police in terms of doing their job on our roads. So I think you do have to take real care in this area. It's not just a case of whether you're hairy-chested enough to make a call.
Did you actually have advice in that direction, that if you did move from this, there was a risk that there could be a backlash, or was this something that
Kevin... It's Kevin's judgment.
Okay. Thanks very much. So moving on, Pacific Forum. Next Tuesday, I'll leave for the 41st Pacific Island Forum Leaders Meeting in Vanuatu. This is a major gathering for South Pacific countries each year. I'll have bilateral meetings with Forum Chair, Prime Minister Natapai of Vanuatu, and with a number of other Pacific leaders over the course of this meeting. The theme for this year's forum will see a focus in our discussions on social and economic needs in the region. This includes improving development assistance through the implementation of the Cairns Compact on strengthening development coordination in the Pacific. Also under review will be the region's progress in advancing the Millennium Development Goals. These are goals for Pacific countries to attain by 2015 in areas such as poverty and maternal and infant mortality. Foreign Minister Murray McCulley will also be attending the forum, and we will hold a number of bilateral meetings. I'll be returning to New Zealand on the 6th of August. This morning I addressed the Local Government New Zealand Conference in Auckland. At the conference I spoke of my desire to see voter turnout increase in this year's local body elections. I find it concerning that voter turnout at the last local body elections was only 44%, the lowest turnout since the restructuring of local government in 1989. This is a worrying trend because all voters, not just ratepayers, should be interested in the business of their local councils. Our local authorities run the amenities that we use frequently, the parks, public libraries and art galleries. Local authorities also grant resource consents, prepare communities for natural disasters and administer grants for local initiatives. Given their importance to local communities, I'd like to see more people engaged in their local body elections in October. In terms of my activity this week, tomorrow I'm having breakfast at Warehouse up at Victoria University and also going to open the new JB Weir office at the Stock Exchange. On Wednesday I'm in Wellington for most of the day before going to Hamilton to open the base, a new shopping centre with King Tuhatia. On Thursday I'll be going to a number of events in the Hauraki Waikato area, and I'm also spending Friday morning in Hamilton for the Motel Association of New Zealand's conference. The House this week will spend most of its time on the committee stages of the Appropriations 2010-11 Estimates Bill, known as the Estimates Debate. The Ngāti Tuwhare Toa, Rokawa and Te Ara River Iwi Settlement, Waikato River Bill will receive its first reading, and progress will be made on the committee stage of the Infrastructure Bill.
Prime Minister, have you been briefed on the leak of the classified United States military documents and the references to New Zealand in them?
I wouldn't really say I've been briefed. I mean, someone brought it to my attention. I understand that there was an incident about 5 years ago. The only involvement of the New Zealanders was that they actually filed the report, and that's about it. That's all I know.
What incident are you referring to?
The one that's been brought to my attention is when the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police were involved in an incident. I understand that they misunderstood, you know, who they were under fire from, so that's why it was a friendly fire incident.
Okay, between New Zealand, that's attended there?
I think New Zealand just reported on it because in that area, it's the only one I'm aware of.
In terms of the other, some of the other references, they're largely positive. New Zealand is diffusing IEDs or coming across IEDs in unusual forms, such as on a bicycle and things like that. Are you pleased to hear that the leaks relating to New Zealand are positive?
Well, I haven't read the report, but my experience of being on the ground in Afghanistan and all of the anecdotal evidence I get is that New Zealand does a wonderful job there, and whether it's our people with the SAS or whether it's ultimately our provincial reconstruction team, I think New Zealanders can be proud of the efforts we're making towards trying to bring peace and stability in Afghanistan.
And Wayne Mack, when he was coming into Afghanistan, his Hercules was subject to a threat from a missile. Did you know that?
No. But we have technology on that aircraft to help detect and, where possible, to try and ensure that that doesn't lead to the wrong sort of outcome. And whether that was deployed, I don't know.
Prime Minister, Helen Kelly has published an open message to you today accusing you of breaking your word around Helen's development relations process, union access to the workplace and non-union collective bargaining. She says that further consultation promised by you to the union before any decisions would be announced. Is she correct?
No, I wouldn't accept that. What I can tell you is in the course of 2009 there were a couple of meetings from memory with the CTU. My recollection of those meetings were that the primary area of concern was in relation to collective bargaining, something that was actually in the monopoly on collective bargaining, something that was actually in our 2008 manifesto. But I chose not to implement that even though we'd campaigned on it, because it was an issue of significance raised by the unions. Look, I vaguely remember them raising the issue about union access, but it was never in the sort of level of concern that the monopoly was. And I'll just make the point that post those meetings I had with them, I spoke to the Council of Trade Unions. In my speech, I specifically said, again, let me be up front, I understand the Minister of Labour has taken the first look at these issues. This is in relation to collective bargaining and in relation to union access. The Cabinet is yet to consider any recommendations. However, the fact that these issues have not been progressed more rapidly reflects where they sit in the Government's agenda. They are not a driving priority. That is not to say the Government is ruling out any future changes to employment law. And that was really... No, I have clear recollection of saying to you, look, I don't see them as a high priority issue, and I don't in isolation, but as a package, they formed part of that package. But I do remember them being very agitated and concerned about the monopoly issue, and we dealt with that issue in their favour, I might think.
Are you saying that union access issue is well into the future from the fact that it happened in this term, and that if it is going to happen, we'll go back to and discuss it?
No, we're not going to go back and discuss. I mean, it'll go through a select committee process. They'll be free to put in their concerns. I see it as a very moderate and balanced change. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask anybody that goes into the workplace just to announce that they're going to go into that workplace, but it'll go through a select committee process.
So, Kelly has made some fairly aggressive comments about CTU's future relationship with your government. Are you concerned?
Well, notwithstanding the support that the union movement has for Labour, we try and be constructive with the union movement. We're going to continue to be so.
She said the relations are fully over and that they're already looking towards protest action and strike action as well. Is that a concern?
Well, I can't stop them doing that. They'll lead New Zealanders to judge whether it was a moderate and fair programme of change in employment law. In my opinion, it is. Well, I'll leave them to go and reflect on their major argument with me was around the monopoly of union rights in terms of collective bargaining, and we haven't actually implemented what we campaigned on in 2008, so if that's not a constructive relationship, I'll leave them to think about that.
How would you describe the level of trust between your government and the union movement at the moment?
Oh, look, I'm not going to characterise it.
Immigration is, like someone showed me, is a big issue across the Tasman, and it's not surprisingly the role of New Zealand in Australia's immigration. Are you aware of what's being mooted by the Liberals over there? Where they seem to be not for, at least they are not ruling out including New Zealand in their
negotiations? Well, we haven't had any discussions with them, so I've really only seen the public comments that Tony Abbott has made in relation to promising a lower level of migration to Australia. At the end of the day, I'd be surprised if that meant a reduction in the access rights that New Zealanders enjoy to travel to Australia. I can't rule that out because I simply don't know, but I'd be surprised if that was the case. Last time I looked, Australia has welcomed New Zealanders as a very important source of human capital, but in the end it's for Australia to determine their own policies and I'll allow them to do that.
Yeah, how much of a concern would that be though if that was the policy
over? Well, look, if we thought it was seriously going to impact on New Zealanders' rights to go to Australia, I'm sure we would take that up with the relevant government, but let's just all see how it plays out.
I mean, would it be damaging for the relationship if they were going to... Because, I mean, fashion Kiwis is an easy hit in Australia, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, look, as I say, last time I looked, New Zealanders were a welcome source of employee in Australia, so I'd be surprised if they moved there.
On the other side, I mean, Labor there as well, Governor Smith, is pulling back on immigration. Do you think the consequence of that might be actually more immigrants wanting to come to New Zealand if they can't get into Australia?
Well, it might be. I mean, again, New Zealand has tried to take, a responsible attitude to migration. That is to say, our population has been rising, despite the fact that we've had New Zealanders leaving, going, living overseas. That's because we've, on balance, there's been a net inflow of migrants coming to New Zealand, ranging sort of anywhere between 0 and 50,000 in any one given year. Our government supports migrants coming to New Zealand. We obviously expect them to be able to either bring skills or to bring capital, certainly to bring the right attitude or to fit within our refugee resettlement program. And with any of those categories and family reunification, I think we've got the balance about right. So to me, it's never an issue about numerics, about whether the number is too large or too small. It's about what people bring to the table. Well, my understanding is no, but I can't officially speak for her, but I'm under the impression from MFAT's briefing to me that she's not going.
Has there been any further contact between you or anyone in our government and Australia about the regional or proposed regional processing centre?
Look, formally, no. I've got a feeling that Murray McCulley was with Stephen Smith. I might be wrong on that fact, but I've got a feeling he's either had a discussion with him or he might have been with him. I don't know whether it's been a formal meeting. You'd have to take that up with the Minister's office, but I think they may have had some discussions, but certainly I haven't at my level.
I mean, how much of a go do you think that idea is? Do you think it's a serious suggestion from her, or it's something that she's throwing out there?
My sense is it would be a serious issue. They need to find a solution, and I think if they are the government, they'll certainly go down the path of exploring that. Now, what it leads to and what involvement New Zealand might have is a discussion for another day, but I'd imagine if Julia Gillard becomes or remains as Australia's Prime Minister post the election on August 21st, then I have no doubt that there'll be a discussion between herself and myself about that issue.
I mean, do you have any intention, or do you think there'd be any likelihood of asylum seekers who make it to New Zealand, and most of those are doing so on aircraft at the moment, being sent to any regional processing centre? Or would it purely and simply be Australian asylum seekers who are being taken to New Zealand?
Well, as you probably be aware from the numbers, those coming via aircraft have significantly reduced over the last 10 years or so for a variety of reasons, but primarily because of good work by immigration and others and the penalties that airlines face if they bring people illegally on aircraft. The main area of concern for New Zealand is the potential for a boat to come here, and that's well traversed areas between myself and yourself.
Julia Gillard still speaking to her government too.
No, I don't have a preference.
Do you think Nauru might be a problem, though, given the controversy around what happened with the temporary refugees who were sent there?
Again, I just wouldn't want to speculate on that. I mean, at the end of the day, we're happy to have that discussion, and that's literally the level it's at. You know, how it might play out, what the specifics are, is just a step way too far today.
What do you say to those critics who say that, you know, this is an Australian problem essentially, and we've got no reason to be involved?
Well, I've got a couple of options. Either I accept the intelligence advice that I get on a very regular basis that indicates that last year alone, 6 boats attempted to come to New Zealand, or I say, look, I'm going to ignore that advice and I won't worry about it. Now, personally, I'm not going to ignore that advice. That means that I've at least got to consider the issue. We're not arguing the case that New Zealand needs to do anything more than consider that, and that's what we would do with the Australian Prime Minister. We're certainly not trying to over-exaggerate things, but I'm getting a constant stream of advice that there's a potential issue, and it's my responsibility as Prime Minister to address that. Well, you're right that it's due soon. I can't offer an opinion on that yet because I simply don't know. The Finance Minister's handling the review and he indicated to me recently that in the foreseeable future he'll be in a position to reflect the findings of that review and any further work that might be required, but he hasn't been in that position yet. So in due course that may be the case, but I don't know today. That sounds quite extreme, but we would need to work our way through it. And as I say, you know, my primary point of contact for reflecting on this issue is clearly the Infrastructure Minister, or Minister of Finance in this case. So I'll deal with Bill English and worry about the members' bills later.
Has Cabinet seen the ACC stocktake or discussed the ACC stocktake and the competition issue yet?
Haven't seen it yet, no. I've had an indication of what the draft might look like. It's very early days, but Cabinet hasn't considered it yet. There's been no Cabinet paper put up.
You made a pretty fair time to announce the competitions being added that you hoped to receive them.
I think it's a little bit early. I mean, I hadn't seen the final draft and I'd rather do that. And I've really only had a high level discussion. So I think it's just a little bit too early to comment on that.
There's been some comment about the Rundle Company powering the.
Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, I think too much can be made of that. I mean, people come here primarily, would be my assessment, to actually watch rugby and to enjoy the very best of New Zealand. And that might include some alcohol, a glass of wine or a couple of beers, but it's not limited to that. And I think for the vast bulk of people that will come here, they'll want to experience all facets of New Zealand life. I think they'll want to get a sense of our culture. I think they'll enjoy all sorts of delights in terms of our wine and food, our scenery in other parts of New Zealand. And I think if you go and have a look at a normal rugby trip, let's take the Lions tour and they were last out here, yep, I mean, they're an audience that's known for wanting to have a good time, but they also behave themselves impeccably. And while the numbers might be larger for the Rugby World Cup, I imagine it'll be the same. There'll be a festival-type atmosphere. Well, again, Party Central's never been just solely a place where people go and consume alcohol. I mean, we have visions for Party Central to be a place where we hold all sorts of events. I mean, there'll be events during the day in terms of maybe cultural events. We imagine that bands will be down there. There may be all sorts of fairs and different things happening. So it's a multi-purpose site. But, yeah, it's a place where there's going to be quite a lot of celebration. There'll be big TV screens. There'll be two, in terms of Queen's Wharf, at least two and maybe three cruise ships parked there. So it is going to be a place where there's a lot of celebration. But, you know, that's one aspect of it, but it's not its role in totality.
At the Pacific Forum, are you going to be discussing the Millennium Development Goals relating to overseas aid?
That may come up in the broader communique. I haven't sort of seen advice on that yet, but I mean, usually New Zealand takes the opportunity to reaffirm its commitment to aid, and certainly aid as it's relevant in the Pacific. But whether it steps out to our broader aid ambitions, I don't know. But given that there's no change in New Zealand's position, we've committed to lifting our level of ODA, and we've been quite active in the Pacific in the last 21 months that we've been in the government. I'm sure that there'll be a fair bit of both support and confidence in what New Zealand's doing.
Are you still looking to raise it to 0.7%?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's clearly the long-term goal, and we are a long way away from that. I mean, I've always been of the view that obviously if we can afford to, lifting our financial contribution is important, but it's also important to recognise that New Zealand makes a contribution well in excess of its the amount of cash that we give as a percentage of GDP. For instance, trade is one of the most effective ways to lift countries out of out of poverty if they find themselves in that position. Now, we have a very open trading market. We're providing support in a lot of other ways with people. So it's not just cash. I think that's one defining point, but it's not the only one.
So will you be holding to that 0.7% goal then?
Yeah, but I mean, as I say, it's a long-term objective. We're quite a long way away from that today.
So what kind of time frame would that be then?
I don't know.
Ballpark?
Don't know. I mean, I think from memory we're 0.3 or 0.32 or something in that magnitude at the moment, so we're quite a long way away.
Have you heard any answers yet about how that diplomatic cable was leaked into the
No, we don't. So I'm doing that. In fact, we'll be undertaking that work and see how that goes.
Have they not made any progress?
No, but they're working on about 5 other leaks for me as well, and they haven't made much progress on those either. But if you want to give us any tips of where information comes from, I'm all ears. Give me a ring. No, progress has been made on that, and Ian Rennie's been reporting to me, just generally in terms of the status of that. I don't know the final conclusions, but I know that he's quite close to making some recommendations.
What's taken so long?
Yeah, I know. Look, well, that just shows you the extent to which cabinet documents are distributed far and wide when they're put together, particularly if it's something like a budget, but even beyond that, they're an extensive reach in public service. So he has undertaken, as I understand it, a very thorough investigation, and that includes full interviews with people, full researching of email logs, of phone logs. So this has been a very thorough attempt to try and get some answers.
And do they see those answers,
though?
Not
as far as I'm aware at this point.
About
well, I haven't, in fairness, seen the report, but I'll be surprised if he passes me a name, unfortunately.
So that's a thorough investigation.
Well, I think that shows you the challenge. I mean, ultimately, if someone wants to give information to someone else, it's quite possible to do that. And we just need to acknowledge that can and does happen. I mean, we, in the end, under a Westminster system, you rely on having a neutral and independent public service. And in my experience, the vast bulk of people operate in that manner. They operate without political bias and with the best interest of giving the best advice they can to the government of the day. But you have to acknowledge that there might be two people who don't. And if they choose not to, then that information is quite easy to distribute to others.
You talked about how widely spread campaigns can be.
Well, I'm reluctant to do that simply because it reduces the quality and level of advice we have. But I remember at one point during the budget process, there was a log kept of everyone who had access to certain elements, I think, of the tax package, and it was in the hundreds. So it's a very broad number of people that have access to information.
Is Mr. Rennie, did you say he's going to you directly?
Well, he's certainly been giving me an update. He's been writing to me every couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, just simply saying he's working on the process, he's getting close to making some decisions, but I haven't seen the report yet.
Why are you not the State Services Commission?
Oh, it's just been copied, it's probably a copy to me, maybe going to Tony, but I've certainly seen a copy of those file notes.
Just returning to aid for a moment again, are you looking at increasing proportion this term or next term?
Well, I think we've indicated we are going to increase, we're on our way to $600 million from memory, off the top of my head. So we are increasing the amount that we're giving. I don't know what that's doing as a percentage. I think it's slowly rising. But I'd need to go and check the budget documents to be absolutely sure.
And that would be this term?
Again, I'd need to check that. Okay, thanks so much.